Hey everybody, this is Mike Van Meter, and welcome to the Mike Van Meter Show, and this is your one-stop shop for everything having to do with the Constitution, freedom, liberty, and I think, frankly, just the best way to live your life. And as you all know, we are quickly going into election season. If you haven't noticed, we're in election season right now, and it looks like Donald J. Trump is quickly going to be the nominee on the Republican side of the House, and then you have Joe Biden on the other side, and we'll see how long that lasts. But if you live in the Commonwealth of Virginia, you know that this is a yearly thing. I just came off of the run for the state Senate here in Virginia, and no time to breathe. It's already back into the next cycle, and really looking forward to the run this year for the United States Congress here in the 11th District of Virginia. That's Northern Virginia, if you're not familiar with that. And that's kind of what we're going to be talking about with our guest today. You know, some of the work that she's doing and, you know, all the great stuff that's going on. And I want to just tell you, I'm very excited for this particular guest. We have Katie Gorka with us. And what an honor to speak with her. And we actually ran into each other last night at an event here in Northern Virginia. And that was the, it was an Asian town hall meeting at the George Mason University, and got to meet a lot of great folks there and had some great discussions. And Katie was gracious enough to come on to the program here today, and we're going to talk about what's going on with her and how we can save this great nation of ours. And so just if you guys don't know about her background, very impressive background. You know, she was a research fellow for outreach at the Heritage Foundation, so a lot of experience over there. And you know, really, in 2016, Katie joined the Trump transition team and then served as a senior advisor in the Office of Policy at the Department of Homeland Security from 2017 to 19. And that's where she focused on the strategies for the prevention of terrorism and targeted violence for combating use on the internet for terrorism and human trafficking. And then from June to August of 2019, she served as a press secretary for the U.S. Customs and Border Protection service. And that's interesting, because during that time frame that she was working there, I was also working counterterrorism, you know, with the FBI, and I retired in July of 2019. So we have parallel backgrounds in that area. I was in the FBI, and then she was working over here with the Trump team. And God willing, we're going to have Donald J. Trump here in office again this year. So it's going to be an exciting year. But I just wanted to set that up. And she's also very active here in Northern Virginia. And in fact, she is now running to become the chairman of the Fairfax County Republican Committee. And that can be quite a fight as well. And I want to hear all about that. So with all that being said, Katie, welcome to the show.
Hey, Mike. Thanks so much for having me. I'm really excited to be here on this President's Day.
Oh, I know. I didn't mention that. Thank you for bringing that up. That is such a great point. And, you know, fill in the blanks with your background. What do you want people to know? And where are we going with you in this great nation of ours?
Yeah, I mean, I think the important thing is really just that I spent almost my entire career, probably 30 years, focused on external issues, right? You know, I think what's interesting is I actually started out as a typical leftist, honestly. You know, I think it's not surprising, growing up in the United States of the 60s and 70s, you know, being a teenager in the 1970s, it was a really hard time to love this country. You know, a lot was going wrong. So by the time I reached my 20s, I was not a patriot by any means. I don't think I was, you know, I wasn't bashing my country, but I didn't love my country. And then a really interesting thing happened. The Berlin Wall fell in 1989. And I decided that, it's kind of crazy when I think about it now, but I decided this is an amazing thing. Communism has ended in Central and Eastern Europe. I want to go there and find out about it. I want to go there and see what's happening. And I originally set out to write a book, and I'm sad to say I still haven't written that book. But I had really a life-changing experience, because I woke up to the true beauty and miracle of what the United States is. And it took me leaving this country to really understand that. And it also took leaving this country and going to Central and Eastern Europe to understand what a devastating impact socialism has on societies and how it destroys their soul. So the good news is I met my husband, I met Sebastian in the course of that work, and then I had the great experience of living in Hungary for 12 years. Our children were raised there, and honestly, I loved my time there. It was a great place to raise our kids. But I'll also say this, I mean, you know, in those years after the fall of communism, it was still a hard place to live. Corruption was endemic, and that is just one of the side, you know, the side benefits of communism. Corruption is extensive, and that doesn't get cleaned up easily. So eventually we moved back to this country, and then I turned my attention, at that time that was the sort of the rise of the jihadist threat, and I was hired at that time to create a think tank here in Virginia called the Westminster Institute. And the goal of that was to educate particularly our intelligence and law enforcement communities about the Islamist threat. There was, I mean, you would know this from your time in the FBI. When this whole thing started, you know, very few people understood jihadism, right? Not only not understanding Islam itself, but that radical Islamism and terrorism, there was very little understanding. So I ran the Westminster Institute, and then, yes, eventually DHS and the Heritage Foundation. And the only last thing that I'll say about this is, you know, and sort of in terms of the path that I've taken is, I loved my time at the Heritage Foundation. I just think the world of the Heritage Foundation. But I came to the realization, I left there two years ago. By that time, I came to the realization that Washington is not going to save us, right? You know, it's crazy where our country has gone since, I would say, 2019, 2020. I think the sort of key turning points were the 1619 Project, which was published by the New York Times in August of 2019. That was sort of the opening salvo where the New York Times came out and said, you know, we are a systemically racist nation, and the only way you're going to fix it is to tear the country down and build something entirely new, right? And it was built on a lot of falsehoods, which, you know, many historians have demonstrated that. And then, of course, we had the George Floyd protests of 2020. And I think those were the real turning points. And then, of course, COVID, which kind of ripped the cover off and showed a lot of people what was going on in the country. And I said, you know, it's time for me to focus on my community. So when I left Heritage, I said I left for two reasons. One was I had a book contract, and I'm super excited because that book is about to come out. We can talk about that later. But I also said I needed to write that book, but I also said I need to get more involved in my own community, because this, if we're going to fix our country, if we're going to heal our country, we have to do it in our own communities first. And so I've just gotten super involved in Fairfax County, and I love it.
Well, that's, man, there's a lot to digest there. And I'm gonna go back to some of the things that you were talking about. Talk a little bit about, so what is it that you're doing in the community? You're focused on the community, because I agree with you on that, but you're pretty active. So tell us a little bit about that.
Well, I started out in baby steps, which I think is the way a lot of people do. I started out being a greeter at the polls on election day, you know, handing out election material, being outside. I think I then graduated to being an election officer. I'm regularly a chief election officer. I think, you know, if people care about election integrity, you need to sign up and be an election officer. It's the best way you can keep an eye on what's going on. But the other thing I did was, I guess now it would have been 3 years ago, 2 years ago, I guess. A couple things started happening in our community that people were upset about. So first, our library hosted a drag queen story hour for toddlers. And then the McLean Community Center hosted Nicole Hannah Jones, the author of the 1619 Project, for a talk. Our little community center paid $35,000 for Nicole Hannah Jones to come talk for 45 minutes and tell us all what a racist nation we are. And that made a lot of people really upset, and rightly so. So I ran for the board at the community center, and I did not get on the first time, but I got on the second time. So that was something else that I did. And then, as you mentioned, I'm running for chair of the Fairfax County Republican Committee. So one of the really eye-opening things that I've done in this sort of journey is I, this was kind of an amazing experience, but I raised my hand this past fall and volunteered to run our door-knocking effort in my big district, that's one of the districts of Fairfax County, to run the door-knocking effort to get out the vote for our local elections, which, as you know, those local elections are so, so important. And it was a really amazing experience because, first of all, the 10 volunteers that I was originally assigned by the party, out of the 10, only one showed up. And trying to get people to door knock is really, really hard because, to be fair, it is a scary, uncomfortable thing to do. I myself did not want to do it, but I had signed up for this, so I had to do it. And I'm telling you, over the course of, I spent 10 weeks door knocking, and it was so eye-opening because it was such, it turned out actually to be such an amazing way to connect with people in the community. I didn't have a single negative experience. Nobody yelled at me. And I'll tell you the other thing is, by the end of it, I had a team of 35 volunteers. And what's really interesting about door knocking is most people, unless they've done it a lot before, they're uncomfortable with it. But if you get them started, they get quite passionate about it for that very reason, because it's a way to connect with people in the community. And it's a way to find people who care about these issues as we do, but are not yet engaged. And so I think door knocking is super, super important. And I'll just mention one last thing that I've done is with a friend, I started a group called Catholics Engaged for Fairfax. Our goal with that was just to make sure that Catholics in Fairfax are educated about the issues and the candidates, and to make sure that they get out and vote their values. And one of the things that we were able to do with our group was we hand wrote 19,000 get out the vote postcards for this last local election, just asking our fellow Catholics in Fairfax to get out and vote their values, to vote for parents' rights and to vote for protecting life. So we weren't, you know, identifying particular candidates, but asking people to get out and vote their values. So those are the main things that I've been involved with.
Well, you've been really busy. That's for sure. And focusing on the community, I think is fantastic. And we really need that here in Fairfax County, because I can tell you, of all the districts, both like when I ran for the state senate, I ran for the 33rd district and did not win that election. And I'm now running against Jerry Connolly here on the 11th. And there are a lot of people who tell me that I can't win this. I mean, like, why are you even bothering? I mean, a Republican is not going to win in Northern Virginia. And I don't know that I accept that premise. I don't accept that premise, because the fact is that if you ran the numbers, and I've seen the numbers, that if every single Republican, a person that's registered as a Republican, or those that claim to be conservative, maybe they're not even Republican, but they tend to be conservative. That includes some Democrats. If they all voted, we would win elections. We do have an elected Republican up here in Northern Virginia, so it is possible. But I think what happens is people just are not engaged. And with you mentioned the events of 2020 and everything that happened after 2020, and I've scratched my head because if the events after 2020 and what happened with, you know, George Floyd and all this stuff, the 1619 project, and out here in Loudoun County, the school board issues that we've had those issues with Fairfax County as well. If those issues do not drive people to vote and vote their conscience, I don't know what will. And I think people like you, getting out and setting that example and getting active in the community and door knocking and holding these, you know, voting your value, not just voting your values, but talking about your values and getting others motivated. That's how we're going to start winning these elections. And we have to, because this election here is critical. Now, I know every election, everybody says this is the critical. There's never been an election like this. Well, I know you, we've all heard that, but there really is not an election like the one that we have coming up. And this is vitally important because it's possible we could lose this country if we continue down the road. In fact, I'm convinced if we continue down the road that we've been down the last 3.5 years, we're going to lose this whole thing. And the world is going to turn into chaos. I mean, I know that's a lot there, but do you agree with me? And or what are your thoughts on that?
I couldn't agree more. It just blows my mind. I truly don't understand. I don't understand a single person who doesn't vote. And I think, you know, I'm going to argue. Okay, so I'm first of all totally with you. I think this next election is the most important of our lifetime. But I'm going to say something else. I think this last local election was hugely important, and I think it's going to be disastrous for Virginia that we lost that local election. And I'll tell you why. If you pay attention to what's happening down in Richmond right now, you know, it seems really clear to me that what the Democrats have decided to do is because I think they realize that they're, how shall I say, like, they don't have a lock on things from a policy position. Let's put it that way. They know that there's a lot of resistance to what they do and a lot of rejection of their policy positions. So I think it seems clear that they have decided to go after the electoral system. And what's really interesting is to look, we have, I think, 13 bills that the Democrats have put forward right now that have crossed over, right, that are going to make it up to the governor's desk, all to do with election integrity. And I'll just give you one example of how serious it is, what they are trying to do. So right now in Virginia, illegal immigrants can get what's called a driver privilege card. It's got a little number 9 on it. It says limited federal, privileges, something like that. There are little indications on it that tell you that it's a driver privilege card and the person is not allowed to vote. Okay. And the other thing is this driver privilege card can only go to illegal immigrants until their second birthday after they've received this card, right? It's a temporary card. So they can have it for a maximum of 2 years and then it has to be renewed. The Democrats have put forth a bill that says all of these markings are going to be removed, which means when you're checking this person in, if you're a poll worker, you won't have any way of knowing that they can't vote, right? And this same bill proposes that these people, that this card have an 8-year duration. So this just opens the door wide to illegal immigrants voting in the state of Virginia. And that's just one of the things that they've proposed. I mean, it's crazy. So, you know, the fact that people aren't engaging, they are going to pay a heavy, heavy price. But I'm with you. You know, I think the challenge is for us, right? People like us who understand this, who are passionate, who love our country, we want to save our country. I think that the challenge is how do you reach people and how do you persuade them of the importance of voting? And I personally feel that emails, texts, and anything that comes in anonymously is of very limited utility. I mean, I know it still has to be done. Signs are important. Slogans are important. Emails are important. But I am a big believer that it's the person-to-person contact that ultimately makes the difference. And I'm telling you, you know, this is one of the things I learned in doing the research for my book. This is how the left has done it. And this is how we have to do it. So I would argue, and I think it's already happening. Okay. I will say that. I think the Republicans are understanding this better. And I think they're doing a much better job of sort of reaching into the community and engaging. But I would say Republicans here in Fairfax, at least, have to do a better job of getting out into the community, engaging with people, and bringing them in.
All right, absolutely. Absolutely agree with that. And I think that this meeting that you and I were at last night was a prime example of that, where there's logic that's starting to come through. And when they meet you face to face, and I'm going to give you an example of something I experienced during the state campaign that highlights and puts, you know, really just puts a star on what you're talking about. I did a lot of outreach with the Muslim community. And, you know, at first I was thinking, okay, well, this is a demographic that's not going to be very receptive to a Republican. And when I went to various mosques, and they were very gracious, they actually gave me about 5 minutes at each mosque to address the folks that were there. And I was very surprised at the response that I got. I was very pleased to see how like patriotic everybody was, and they were they wanted to meet me, and they said things like this. And I think this kind of highlights what you're talking about, how Republicans are not historically not real good at this. Is every mosque they came up to me and said, you know, you're the only Republican that's ever come here to talk to us. You're the only one. And they really appreciated it. And they were, for that particular election, this whole transgender ideology and transitioning and keeping this information from parents in schools was a big issue for them. And they wanted to talk to me about that. And they said, listen, we don't support this at all. You know, we're very upset. Now, this wasn't a state issue, but they said, we're very upset with how the United States pulled out of Afghanistan, the way that it was done. And we're very upset about that, and they wanted to talk about it. But the point was that they really appreciated the fact that I was there in person and was willing to talk to them about it. And it was good. It was a great experience. But it is that face-to-face. They have to see you. They have to be able to hear you, hear what your values are, and they want to have their values heard. And that's so important. And so I really appreciate you sharing that. And we saw some of that last night at the meeting that we were at, didn't we?
I thought it was great. Yeah. So last night was a meeting of the Virginia Asian Advisory Board. and they had, you know, I think this is so my understanding is that this is something that Governor Youngkin, I don't know if he created it, if he put it together, but it's something they advised the governor, right?
There's a number of boards. Like there's an addictions board, there's this Asian board, there's a Hispanic board. There's a number of advisory boards. Mm-hmm.
So do you consider these are governmental?
They're not run by the government. It's something that the governor has that he will have community leaders in these particular groups that will give him advice. Now, he doesn't have to take the advice, but these are people ostensibly that have expertise in whatever that particular issue is and that present to him the ideas. Because I've done presentations to the Addiction Advisory Board, and it really just kind of helped. I mean, of course, the governor is not going to be an expert in every area out there. So he's, you know, I'll give him credit for that. He surrounds himself with people that will have this very educated discussion with him on a particular issue. And that's what last night was in this particular area.
Yeah. So one of the things that I mean, there were a couple things that really struck me about last night's meeting. One was, you know, I hear what you're saying, that I think it's important for different communities to hear us, those of us who are running, and for them to hear our values. But I was thinking last night as well, it's super important for us to hear them. So I heard some of these Asian Americans saying things that I'd really not heard before. And they really sort of went to my heart. Like they were very moving, you know. So for example, there's been a big issue in Virginia because we've been revising our history curriculum. And one of the things that they've been really fighting for is to get some of the history of Asians and Pacific Islanders into the history curriculum. And I thought that was really, really moving. And then you heard, there were several people who talked about the fact that, you know, they love this country. Some, you know, many of them have been here for generations. Some have just even come in their own lifetimes, but they all see themselves as fully American, patriotic, and yet they feel invisible or even discriminated against. And I think that's important for us to hear. And then finally, the other real takeaway for me was, you know, and they are the first ones to say that they put a very, very heavy emphasis on education, on particularly on STEM, on the sciences, on math. You know, I think as we know, like Thomas Jefferson, I think was 75% Asian maybe before they started changing the whatever the basis on which they accepted people. They had amazing things to say about how we need to rethink education. So I thought that Dr. Ra was particularly compelling. He's a professor at George Mason. And he was saying, you know, the way we teach math, the sequence, algebra one, algebra two,
geometry.
Geometry. Yeah. Thank you. Geometry. Then it goes to calculus. And he said, we've been doing that for 40 to 50 years. And he said, we really need to change that, because he said, for example, that the whole future is going to be based on AI. It's super, super important. And he said, even seventh grade is not too young to be teaching things like AI and quantum computing. And I thought, amen, you know, let's rethink it. Let's rethink education. So, you know, I'm also just a huge believer. Our greatest resource, it's not oil, it's not land, it's not anything, it's the people, right? And if we don't listen to people, if we don't give them a voice, we don't get to take advantage of that resource. We don't grow, right, without that resource. And I just thought last night was super, super inspiring. I loved it.
Yeah, and we've got to do a much better job at doing that. And they really highlighted the racism that's going on in Northern Virginia. And I think the last election really addressed that as well. That let's see how I'm going to characterize this properly. The whole notion of DEI, where it's equal outcomes, right? It's not equality, it's equal outcomes, which is very different than having equal opportunity. And the Asian community in particular, and last night highlighted this, has been affected by this, because you have a community of people. And by the way, my wife is Asian. So I've been in that world as far as like the cultural background that you have, where education and hard work is highly, highly valued. And so you have this community of people that really value and came to this country for these opportunities. And we heard that last night. And these folks are working hard and they're putting emphasis and they're doing all the right things. And now it appears that they're being penalized for that. And that's at the crux of what's been going on with Thomas Jefferson, and not just Thomas Jefferson, but a lot of the other schools. You know, we had this incident where many of the kids were not even notified that they had received, were now eligible for particular awards and scholarships. And it appears that that was intentional. That's discrimination. And that we have to end that. This is divisive to this nation. It's not fair to people that are working hard. And we have to have this meritocracy, because they talked about that meritocracy last night. They talked about that last night. And that's important, that competitive edge in this country, because after all, you know, we can talk about DEI and we can talk about equity and we can talk about how important that is. But you know what? At the end of the day, when you are going in to have your open heart surgery or brain surgery or any kind of surgery in a hospital, I think you want the best doc. I think you want the doctor that did the best in school, or that pilot, or, you know, name any profession that if we think that competitiveness is not, competition's not important, well, it is important when it's your life on the line or your loved one's life on the line in these critical fields that we have. And it's not right. It's not good for the nation to do that. And it's not good and not fair to people that are working. I mean, those are just my thoughts. I don't know how you feel about that.
Oh, no. So I had a colleague at the Heritage Foundation who does really exceptional work on this question. And he looked at, so this is Jay Green, Professor Jay Green. He did this incredible study on high schools that have DEI administrators. And he found that, in fact, the achievement gap widened in schools that have DEI administrators rather than narrowed, which is the intention. Now, he wasn't able to determine causality. One can only guess. It's partly because resources are being wasted on the wrong things, right? And I will just say, for example, here in Fairfax County, the DEI, the title is, the administrator who handles DEI, I think makes a salary of around $260,000 a year. And this is in a school system that is really struggling to retain teachers. Now, a teacher in the Fairfax County Public School System, the most qualified teacher, which is a teacher with a master's degree and something like, I can't remember what the number is, 20, let's say 25 years experience, the maximum they can make is $130,000. And yet this DEI administrator is at $265,000. It is not a good use of resources. And I just, you know, I hope that schools will wake up to what the facts are telling us about the DEI approach. It is a failed approach, and we need to turn it around.
Yeah, we absolutely do. And I that whole case has fallen off the radar. I don't know where they are right now, but I know that TJ was being looked at. Have you heard anything recently about that?
No, they're not backing down. They're going forward with it. They've, you know, so just for, you know, for anybody that's not aware, Thomas Jefferson High School, which is consistently either the number one or the number two high school in the country, abandoned its meritocracy sort of system for admitting students and has gone to a quota system. And you know, it means that, you know, there's a huge cut to the percentage, particularly of the Asians who are getting into that school. So there are a lot of upset families about that.
How is that not racist? How is it not racist?
It is racist, and that's what the Supreme Court has ruled, you know, in the case that was brought regarding Harvard. But, you know, again, even with the Supreme Court ruling, schools, plenty of schools are finding other ways. You know, you can't come out and say, okay, we have a quota, but there are plenty of other ways to figure it out. I have a son right now who's trying to get into med school. This is a kid who went to Stanford, had great MCAT scores, had amazing grades, was a D1 athlete for 4 years. He cannot get into med school. It's insane. And every single essay, every school that he applied to, and I think he's applied to about 25, every set of secondary essays that you have to write touch in one way or another on diversity. That's all they do. That's all they're asking about is something about diversity. You know, do you, you know, have you ever felt excluded? Have you ever felt like the other? Have you ever had a time where you've stood up for the other? It's just, it's unbelievable how crazy our country has gone.
You know, and it is. And it just seems like it, you mentioned 2020 and the effects after that. And it seems like much of this stemmed from 2020 because, you know, I was growing up, you know, I think you and I are probably roughly the same age. Growing up, I don't remember all of this being a problem. Do you? I don't remember people walking around and saying to themselves, you know, I feel excluded, and let's bring diversity and equity in the workplace. Because I'll tell you, it's everywhere now. Even where I work in the hospital, it's the medical field. And when you look at the mission statements, when you look at every, you know, go around the hospital, it's, they're always talking about diversity and equity as if this has anything to do with what our primary mission at the hospital is. And I don't get it because we've taken an environment where there was not overt racism, and now we've brought in overt racism because what we're talking about is in fact overt racism. It is. But
well,
we've created
and I'll tell
that.
You, I think, right. No, and I 100% I know for a fact it is deliberate. And this is the other piece of the work that I've been doing. You know, I said to you when I left Heritage back in 2022, it's because I was going to write a book. So this book is coming out on April 2nd. I wrote it with my colleague at Heritage, Mike Gonzalez. It's called Next Gen Marxism: What It Is and How to Combat It. So I've spent the last 2 years doing a really deep dive into how did we get here. And this was a very deliberate move by the left. This was what they wanted to do. And so what we found, and this is, you know, what we talk about in the book, is that basically there's, you can draw this long line. It's so hard when you've written a book to try to, you know, discuss it in a concise way, because I've written chapters about this, but I'll just try to say very briefly, that sort of fundamentally what happened was the radical left of the 60s, the radical students, realized that what they were doing was not achieving what they wanted, right? They wanted socialism. They weren't getting it. And so some of them went into law departments, right? Some of them realized this isn't going to work through protests. Let's try to make changes through the law. And you then had the creation of critical legal studies at some of our mainstream universities. That was basically Marxism plus law. That's what that is. But some of them then said, no, the way we're going to bring about the changes we want is through organizing. And a number of groups got started that basically said, let's organize the left. We need to go out and find people and organize them. And they realized, you know, quickly on both sides, race became the number one issue. And I would say it had even happened in the 60s, right? If you really dig into the history of the radical left in this country, they realized early on that race was the wedge that they could drive and to divide this country. Even going all the way back, even if you go back to Lenin, he realized that the way he could sort of gain a foothold in the United States would be to reach out to the African Americans, make them feel aggrieved, help them to see how they're being discriminated against, and that they would then embrace socialism and, you know, whatever, overthrow the country. So this has been something that, you know, what we are seeing today has really truly been in the making for 100 years. And so it's no accident. And I think the thing though that's going to be really interesting is to see, I think people are already waking up to the fact that this is not going to get them what they want. And I'll tell you a funny story. So one of the funniest things to me, let me back up and just say, you've had great voices in the African American community speaking out against this, speaking out against the DEI victimhood narrative. I mean, I just, you know, Glenn Lowry at Brown University, Bob Woodson from the Woodson Center. There are so many, I can't name them all, but something that I just saw that is quite amazing is one of the movies that's been nominated for an Academy Award for Best Picture is called American Fiction. Have you heard of this movie?
I have not.
Oh, you have to watch this movie. It blew my mind. So the storyline, I mean, because this is not just sort of academics or sort of sidelined African-American intellectuals complaining about DEI. This is a mainstream Hollywood movie, and it is totally making fun of the woke culture. I thought it was brilliant. And so, sort of the storyline is, it's a story about a black man who's a writer who is really fed up with the fact that blacks are being reduced to this kind of one-dimensional caricature, that they are sort of downtrodden and kind of ghetto-based, right? I think the fact that it is that a pushback on the wokeness is now in a mainstream Hollywood movie says to me, we've reached the turning point. And I'll tell you, the other place you see it is in comedy. So you're seeing, I think, an increasing number of comedians who are also pushing back and making fun of this, you know, victimhood narrative. So I don't know, maybe God willing there, we're going to see this finally turn around.
Well, I could tell you too, that I thought it was pretty interesting that I think it's July is Pride Month. And I don't want anybody to take anything, read into what I'm saying here. People that want to celebrate their sexuality or whoever, whatever they are, I got that and I get it. But I just want to highlight, you know, something where we have sort of misplaced values. Where I work, you know, in a hospital, we had during Pride Month, an entire month of the Pride flag being flown out in front of our place of employment, booths set up. Constantly talked about, you know, even the screensavers on your computer, you know, had those messages. Okay. And this went on for a month, not a day, a month. And then you roll into September. Now, I work in a drug and alcohol detox unit. So just keep that in mind. September is recovery month, recovery from drugs and alcohol. And I didn't hear anything, nothing, not one word in the hospital, nothing. And one day, about halfway through September, I just sent a big email out to all my coworkers, you know, thanking everybody for being on the front lines of you know, helping people not die from addiction. Because for those of you that don't know, fentanyl alone is the number one killer of people between the ages of 18 and 49 in the United States. Number one. That's just fentanyl. It's not including all the other drugs. Pretty big deal. All right. In fact, I believe that that's a national security issue, but that's another discussion for another day. But it is a big, big, big deal. And so I sent this email out, and then somebody, one of the administrators, came back and said, "Hey, want to thank Mike for reminding us all of the importance of Recovery Month. And yes, you know, thank you for the work that you're doing." But I had to remind them that, you know, what is our primary mission? You know, in the hospital, saving people, our unit in particular, saving people from addiction. Not even mentioned, but we had a month of Pride Month, you know, in the hospital. And again, I'm not disparaging that. I'm just saying, but we're the hospital. And when I sent that email, a lot of my coworkers came up and said, "You know, you're right. Something is off here. There's something askew here." You know, because at the end of the day, Pride Month is about celebrating who you sleep with. And back when I was growing up, who you slept with was considered your private life. And we kept it private. You know, I don't personally care who, you know, people sleep with, but it's sort of misguided. I mean, do you think? I mean, and it's kind of overkill. And furthermore, you know, being a veteran, when Veterans Day came up, nothing, not a word. 4th of July, nothing. All of these other, you know, days that we honor, nothing. But we had a month of Pride. I don't get it. I don't get it. I don't. I think we're missing something here.
Yeah, no, I couldn't agree more. And, you know, I think, the fentanyl crisis, we've had overdoses at all three local high schools in the last month. I think veteran suicide is another huge topic we don't talk about enough. We've got the whole homeless crisis. Yep. And then I will also mention one more that is very near and dear to my heart, which is we've got a real crisis in our foster care system.
You're right.
So Virginia has the second worst rate in the entire country of kids who age out of foster care without a family, without having been adopted, right? And the numbers of what happens to them in terms of the percentage that will either, the girls will become pregnant as single mothers, their kids will go into the foster care system, the guys will go into prison, or they become homeless. I mean, it is a terrible crime. And it's like a wound. These are all wounds in our communities. And yet, we are just being told that the only problem and the biggest problem we have to deal with is racism. And I just don't buy it. I don't buy it that that's our biggest problem.
Not even close.
And but again, I think that's why I think the only way these things heal is at the community level. Because it's, you know, I think when you think about these things in abstract terms, It's hard to relate to them, but it's when you meet somebody, like I got plugged into a great program here in Northern Virginia called, Don't Go Alone. And what they do is they connect, adults with kids who have aged out of foster care in a mentoring program. And so when you get to, you know, work with, we have a young man that we mentor, and, you know, getting to talk to him on a regular basis and to sort of see his struggle and how hard it is. Or similarly, I think this must be true for you too. The fact that you're dealing with people who are struggling with addiction and alcoholism, it's very real for you. And so, you know, in your heart, where the wounds are, where the healing needs to happen, and where we can be helpful to each other as neighbors, as community members. That's what, you know, to me, that's what community is about. And, you know, I recalled when I was doing the research for my book, I found this beautiful quote by Alexis de Tocqueville that I really liked, where he was describing what he found when he was traveling through the United States. This was back in 1831 and 1832. And he said, "Americans of all ages, conditions, and all dispositions constantly unite together to hold fetes, found seminaries, build inns, construct churches, distribute books, and dispatch missionaries. They establish hospitals, prisons, schools by the same method. Finally, if they wish to highlight a truth or develop an opinion by the encouragement of a great example, they form an association." And I think that's the American way, right? We come together when we see a problem and we work together to fix it. And I think that's a big reason why I'm so resentful of things like the 1619 Project and the whole DEI approach and the victimhood narrative, because it says we're systemically racist, and it says we can't work together to solve this. But I think most Americans know better. I mean, I think how far we've come since I was born, right? Just since the 1960s, how much has changed in this country in terms of eradicating racism. And the last thing I'll say about this is I was so conscious of the fact when my kids were little that they were basically race blind. And it was only at some point in school that they started being taught about race, like race was brought to the forefront, right?
Yeah.
I think it's been a terrible mistake what we've done.
Yeah, it is. And my kids were the same way when they got to high. I don't think it was even really until high school that they started saying, what is this all about? And when they, both of my kids, when they started filling out college applications and scholarship applications, this focus on race, both of my kids said, why am I being asked all these questions? What does that matter? You know, and that's a good testament on our society today that my kids wouldn't think that race would matter. But they were finding out, oh, well, it, you know, this may determine whether you get into that school or get your scholarship or not, you know, and that's when they started saying, but I don't understand. I worked hard in high school and I did this on this test I participated in all these clubs. Why isn't that what is important? That my kids would ask me that. What does my race have to do with the fact that, you know, how is that more important than my performance in school? So I think that inherently, even our children understand how unbalanced all of this is. And I do think that this continual emphasis on race further divides the nation, does not bring the nation together. It's creating more problems than it's creating.
No, I couldn't agree more. You know, one thing that's interesting that I think, I mean, I certainly never realized, for example, race was never even a question on the U.S. Census until the late 60s. And it was put there by the people that were trying to elevate race as an issue even back then. And you've had this whole creation of so-called identity politics. And mm-hmm. I'm telling you, this was a strategy of the Marxists and of the left. And I think it's a big mistake. And frankly, I don't think we should be asking people their race on the census. And we shouldn't be looking at it when we let people into school. And if for no other reason, I mean, this was, I think, really fascinating. You know, we've had these arguments like that we should have reparations, right? That money should go from the whites who were slaveholders to the blacks who were the slaves, right? Who were descendants of the slaves. But if you really start to dig into that, you realize there is no black and white. There is so much mixing now. Like who is pure white? Who is pure black? Who is pure Asian? Like there are so many mixed relationships and mixed identities. It doesn't even make sense anymore.
Yeah. And then what do you do with families like mine that fought in the Civil War for the North, and they fought in order to end slavery? So, I mean, are you holding them responsible when they were fighting against? It gets very murky at that point. And that, I mean, you know, could you imagine if I, as a law enforcement officer, I said, "Hey, Katie, I'm going to put you in jail." Well, why? Well, because your great great grandfather robbed a bank.
Exactly.
Huh? You'd be like, yes. What? I mean, it just. And by the way, it makes no. You know, in the recovery world, you know, I work in the addiction world. The patients that really struggle with the past, you know, just obsessing over the way that it was, really end up just living in that. They continue to live in the past. When we talk about, you know, we're here now, and we're going to move forward. We're looking. You drive a car by looking through the windshield. You don't drive a car by staring at the rearview mirror. You look through the windshield because you're constantly moving forward. Were there mistakes? Were there flaws? Were there sins in this nation? Absolutely, there were. But we're not going to. But we don't live there. We are constantly improving. We're constantly getting better. But we don't get better by continuing to live in the past. And there is no one alive. You and I do not know one person alive today that owned a slave in the United States. You and I do not know one person alive today that was a slave in the United States. And we have to stop this. We have to move forward. We need to give people opportunity. We need to give people chances. And that's the greatness of this country, is you have the ability to move up. Now, you're going to say, oh, well, you know, people are privileged and, you know, and all these kinds of things. Well, hold on now. You're not privileged just because you're white. There are a lot of people that are white that are not privileged at all. By the way, I got to tell you, in my own background, I didn't have anything handed to me. You know, I went into the Navy. I went into the military. I have two master's degrees, but you know, it was through my military service that I got one of the master's degrees, and then it was after working a career, and I took out loans that I'm paying back to Mr. Biden. I'm paying those loans back to get the second master's degree. Okay, nothing was handed to me. There was no privilege there. You could say, well, you know, you came from the... No. I went into the military. And trust me, very few of you would ever want to have to do or go to the places that I went to in the military to do that. And so the government allowed me to get a college degree as a result after that. But it was part of me putting myself in places that you do not want to be in. Trust me, you don't want to be there. So I think we need to knock this stuff off too.
And on the flip side, how insulting to equate being black with being impoverished.
That's
true
too.
Or to equate being black with needing extra help, or saying, oh, we're going to lower our expectations on your grades because we just don't think that you can perform at the level of white kids. I think the whole thing is just so backwards and so evil. Honestly, it's evil.
Yeah, it sure is. Well, I tell you, you and I, we have so much to talk about. We could go on for hours, and we should. We should do this again. We should. We should do it again. But hey, before we close out, you are running for chairman of the FCRC, the Fairfax County Republican Committee. Just briefly tell us a little bit about what that is, and when is that election, and what will that mean if you get it?
Yes. So the election is takes place on April 6th at the Fairfax County Republican Committee Convention. If people want to vote in that, they simply have to go to the FCRC website and sign up to be a delegate. I don't even think you actually have to be a member of the Fairfax County Republican Committee, but you do have to sign up to be a delegate. And what will it mean if I win? I think that you know, I love the direction that the FCRC has been going. I think that they've been doing a great job in the last 2 years of better using data, getting out into the communities more, building out the precinct captains, building out the district chairs. And I just want to do a lot more of that. I want to empower people, you know, at the local level to reach their neighbors, provide the training that they need to reach out into their communities. And again, as I said to you, I'm a huge believer that it's about direct contact between people. And I'll just say one last thing about this. You know, for me, this is really not ultimately about politics. It's really about community. You know, I think we've been so divided and so kind of cut off from each other by technology, by COVID, by so many things of the last couple of years. And when I see people kind of get out of their shell and come back together in community, like at events and working together and that kind of thing, it just makes people happier. It really does.
It does. It does. And looking forward to that. So April 6th, sign up to be a delegate with the Fairfax County Republican Committee. Go to their website. And then your book is coming out. And that is going to be The Next Generation, Next Gen Marxism. It's, and that's being released on April 2nd.
So it's already available for pre-order at Amazon. And believe it or not, I don't know how this happened. It's going to be for sale at Target, which I think is really funny. Oh, not that I'll shop there, but it's going to be there. But anyway, it'll hopefully be in bookstores everywhere, but certainly on Amazon. And it's called Next Gen Marxism, What It Is and How to Combat It.
Wow. And we'll have to have you back on and talk about that as well. And so for those of you that stopped going to Target, you can at least go in and buy this book. Do that.
No. Buy it on Amazon. Don't go into Target.
And by the way, how can everybody reach you?
Yeah, so I actually have a website, katiegorka.com. Oh, I hope I'm saying the right thing. I think it's katiegorka.com. And you can reach me through my website.
Oh, fantastic. Well, thank you so much for coming on to the show here today. We'll be talking with you soon.